This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Hello. Enjoying a quaver there, are you?
You caught me crunching on a quaver.
I have to say there's something very satisfying about the sound of a crunch of a quaver.
I love quavers.
Yeah.
Don't you?
Yeah, maybe they'll send us a box now you've said that.
Exactly. Shameless.
So we should just say straight away that we are recording this before we've got any idea what is going on. I mean, I know we say this quite often because there could be a couple of days between us recording it and the episode coming out. But this week especially, we've got no idea what has gone on with this deal. We don't even know if you're working Saturday or not this week.
We think we are, I think.
So I know that this is a very serious subject and the future of the country is at stake and all that. But have you thought about parkrun?
You'll do it for me, won't you? You'll be the ringer.
You're going to send me as a proxy?
Yeah.
I think I would really damage your personal best average if I went and did your parkrun for you this week. Have you ever had a Saturday job when you were at school? Did you have a Saturday job? Never had a paper round?
Really? What about you?
Worked in a chippy for 2 weeks.
How did it go?
Not well. I got fired because I kept dropping too much of the food.
Really?
Very cack-handed. Yeah.
Imagine what I'd have been like.
I know. You and me working in any kind of food preparation, perhaps maybe a make-your-own sandwich shop, it wouldn't go well for us. We're going to be talking about fake news this week.
Yeah, something you know a thing or two about.
What makes you say that?
All that fake news you've been spreading about my make-your-own sandwich idea. I mean, that is just fake news par excellence.
You see, this
you've been, like, frightening people about hygiene issues.
This is a very Trumpian technique. So fake news is two things, isn't it? I mean, there is this problem with, you know, dissemination of news that isn't properly sourced and that is just intended to manipulate. And then there are people in powerful positions
that's true.
Saying things, any criticism... Yeah. That anybody has to offer is fake news.
Yeah,
and I feel like you are falling into the Trump category there.
Yeah, maybe that's true. I'm taking on the expert. But this week we are talking about fake news and disinformation. Obviously, it was a major issue back in 2016, but continues to be an issue. We'll be exploring how much of a problem it could be in upcoming elections, some of the ideas for tackling it. We're talking to a social psychologist from Cambridge about the psychology of why people believe fake news, and he promotes what he calls a pre-bunking. Which is rather than debunking.
It's like pre-distribution.
Yeah, exactly. So I was thinking the same thing. And he's created a game to help do it. Then we're talking to an expert in computational propaganda, that's algorithms and all that malarkey, about the threat of disinformation and the role of tech companies in addressing it. And finally, this will appeal to you, we're speaking to someone from Finland about their approach to tackling fake news, which a number of other countries are trying to learn from. The Flying Finns.
I enjoy a Finn. I enjoy the Moomins.
Yep.
Right up my street.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's an appropriate week to be talking about fake news because we have a publication has arrived. And I don't know if it quite falls into the category of fake news. I know that you are...
Alternative and much better parallel universe, I'd say.
Ed is obsessed with this. It is called Chaos
I'm
with Ed.
I'm obsessed with it.
You are. You mean you just sit there leafing through caricatures of yourself, laughing at them. It's difficult to. I had to take the book away from Ed because it was difficult to get his attention.
Yeah.
It's called Chaos with Ed Miliband. It's a funny book by a guy called Tom Noble, and it's cartoons.
And it shows, thank goodness, what we avoided as a country.
It shows Ed going about his everyday life since 2015 versus what has been going on in the real news. And we'll be talking to Tom, who is the author of that book.
What's your reason to be cheerful?
Saurine Halloween special. They've done Halloween special loaves of Saurine. You not a Saurine fan? Tell them about the Saurine Doreen.
Malt loaf.
Malt loaf, yeah, I love a malt loaf.
That you and my wife.
Is that right?
Yes, she's a massive malt loaf person.
I mean, I'm
not a malt loaf person at all.
I just think malt is an underrated flavour, full stop. I like sprinkling things with Horlicks just to get a bit maltiness into them.
Give me a quaver over a malt loaf anytime.
Oh, imagine a quaver dipped in Horlicks, Ed. No, not for you. But yeah, they've done spooky Halloween edition Saurine. They've got chocolate and blood orange and toffee apple. So I will be availing myself of some of that.
Are you a regular Saurine eater?
I love a bit. So I just like it simple with a bit of butter on it.
Wow.
You don't like it?
It's not a sort of Marmite situation. I don't sort of object to it.
I mean, I could live without the fruit in it, but, you know, the malty loaf, syrupy loaf. Oh, it's fantastic. What about you then?
So my reason to be cheerful... It's about a long-running saga. It feels like it's been going on forever. Lots of views on all sides. It's a relief to finally come to an agreement. And it's about whether our family's going to get a dog. We're not.
Oh.
I mean, I think it's the sort of agreement. It's a sort of de facto agreement. It's the outlet heads of agreement.
Your children are behind this deal.
Well, I tell you why, because we tried out, we did the best thing, which is we sort of dog sat.
Right.
And we've got a really nice arrangement, which is that we've got Dylan, who is a King Charles Cavalier something or other, who we occasionally dog sit, and he's incredibly nice.
Is he a good boy?
Yeah, and he's really
what
nice.
Voice, when you speak to Dylan, what voice do you use? Because everyone has a different voice when they're speaking to a dog.
My normal voice.
So you're tickling his tummy and you're not going, he's a good boy.
No, I didn't do that much of that. And I think what Justine worked out was that the dog sort of enthusiasm to sort of output ratio was slightly misaligned. In other words, you know, everybody was in principle enthusiastic about a dog, but she was the only one who was actually doing anything with the dog.
Right.
Everybody else was sort of looking the other way. So we've got a good arrangement, which is we'll be sort of dog sitters. I mean, I don't think my children have quite realised that this is a sort of definitive, you know, deal.
And there's no way they're ever going to hear this. I mean, why would they listen to this?
I mean, just the trouble is, if you're out at work during the day, it's not great having a dog, is it?
Yeah, but you can get these people. You know, you see those people with the gangs of dogs.
I know, but it's like, as if life isn't complicated.
People who've had very high...
I mean, he is very sweet, isn't he?
He's gorgeous. Look at Dylan. He's such a good boy. I think you'd get a lot more satisfaction out of him if you had a special voice for speaking to him in.
He's calming and nice to... And we took him out to dinner the other night. Not in a restaurant, went to people's house. But and you know, he sort of behaved more or less okay.
Mm.
But he did start sort of barking at between 1:30 and 2:30 in the morning because we hadn't given him proper walkies. So that was a bit... that was a bit sort of... That was our fault because then the next night didn't happen. We had him for a weekend, you see. But anyway, Dylan is the reason to be cheerful.
And there's no chance of reopening this agreement at any point in the future.
Who knows?
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're going to speak now to Sander van der Linden, who is Assistant Professor of Social Psychology at the University of Cambridge. Sander, thank you for talking to us. And can we just start by asking, why do people want to believe fake news? What is going on psychologically with people that we're so drawn to it?
Yeah, pleasure to be on the show. I think there's two competing explanations. Personally, I don't think they're necessarily competing, but I think there's two views in the scientific literature on this. And the one view is that, you know, people are bombarded with information and our perception is very selective. So we attend to things that are important to us and we can't filter out everything and our bandwidth mentally is limited. And so fake news sort of takes advantage of our biases. Or when I stress you out cognitively, you will perform, you know, less well on certain tasks that I might give you. And so that's a well-known fact. And so, you know, on one hand, it's true that, you know, when people are bombarded by information and they don't know what to believe, we might, you know, rely on the wrong sort of rules of thumb. And that's just a consequence of people not processing information very carefully because of the way the information environment is structured. The other explanation, though, is that our perceptions are motivated by our prior beliefs. So, for example, this could be political or a certain worldview you have that actually just colors the way that you process information. I think, you know, a reference to the X-Files, I want to believe, that's often, you know, a common sort of metaphor. But to some extent, you know, that might be what's going on with some political news, and that people are just, you know, strongly drawn to a certain piece of evidence or information or news because they already believe it and want to propagate their beliefs further. So I think both explanations are not mutually exclusive, but I think those are the two main psychological mechanisms at work here.
Where do you sort of stand on the balance between them, do you think?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. I mean, we've been trialing some interventions, and broadly we kind of find that, you know, we can move the needle and help people, you know, spot fake news and become more resistant to it. So what that tells me is that people aren't necessarily fixed in their state of mind. So I think I take this one literature that, you know, we're post-truth and, you know, we're all motivated to believe what we want to believe and there's no hope and, you know, there's alternative facts everywhere. I think, you know, there's some of that. But people are susceptible to reason to some extent. People are flexible in the way that they perceive the world, and we can help people make better judgments when it comes to discerning fake from real news. That tells us that it's not, you know, it's not deterministic.
Can I suggest a sort of anecdotal theory, part of which is rather sort of banal, but is part of this that we've gone from a world of gatekeepers who were deeply problematic but were gatekeepers into a world of Facebook and so on where there are no gatekeepers? So in other words, it's very hard to know what to believe when you see it on Facebook for lots of people. But then secondly, a bit more of an optimistic view, which is if some stuff that is around on social media is sort of debunked, it might lead people to be more skeptical about everything they see on social media, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, I think you make a very good point. I think it to some extent it is very much the case that people are curating their own news feed selection now, or it's curated by social media companies, and there's also problems associated with that. I do think that people are what we call accuracy motivated. So people do have a motivation to have accurate beliefs about the world, but we're easily distracted, and we fall prey to all sorts of issues on the internet with the way that the new media is structured and the way the information is coming at us. So I do think we can help people. This is not to say that there's not certain people who are deeply motivated to spread misinformation, but I think that's a different sort of discussion.
I know you said people are susceptible to reason, but what about this thing, the backfire effect, where actually with some people giving them fact-checking that makes them more entrenched in their views?
Yeah, so the backfire effect was something really prominent, finding that basically if you try to correct something, people become even more firm in their prior beliefs. But what the weight of evidence has now shown is that we should be less certain about the prevalence of the backfire effect than we had previously thought. Having said that, I do think there are issues with debunking and fact-checking in terms of how effective it is. And from our perspective, that's mainly because it comes after the fact. And my concern has been driven partly by this idea of what we call the continued influence of misinformation, which means that if you've been exposed to a conspiracy, a hoax, a myth, something that's false, it's very difficult to correct because now it's lodged in your memory, and when you repeat it for people, that association becomes stronger in any attempt to debunk it. I should add that I'm not saying that fact checks aren't important. I think actually they serve a very important signaling function, that if politicians, you know, get the idea of just, you know, saying whatever they want to the public, that there's some institution that's actually there and is going to correct them. I think the incentive, it disincentivizes this kind of behavior a little bit. So I do think they have an important role, but they're just not as effective, perhaps, as we'd like them to be.
Well, let's talk about something to feel positive about. This is something you have created. You describe it as a fake news vaccine. It's a game. It seeks to tackle disinformation strategies. Can you tell us what it is, how it works, why it works?
Yeah, absolutely. So this game that we've developed is based on what we call a vaccination or an inoculation metaphor. And the idea is this, is just as with regular vaccines, when you inject a small dose of a severely weakened strain or a death strain of a virus, antibodies are triggered in your immune system to help confer resistance against future infection. And it turns out you can do the same with information. If I inject you with a little bit of fake news, a weakened dose, so not so strong that you actually believe it, but a severely weakened dose that allows people to produce mental antibodies against fake news when they're later shown the sort of the full-blown version of the fake news. And we've later gamified this approach. And the strategy of the game is rather than trying to sort of vaccinate people against, you know, specific falsehoods about specific issues, maybe we can stay clear of specific issues and actually just help people recognize the techniques that underlie the production of most fake news. So things we cover are, you know, polarizing people, conspiracy theories, the use of emotions to manipulate you, trolling, discrediting other people, you know, basically your fake news.
Jeff was brilliant at the game, by the way, which, I mean,
just, he was brilliant.
Just given what you just said, I think says quite a lot.
So,
Jeff,
so I played it earlier on. My final screen said, please don't tell me everybody gets this. Mission accomplished. Congratulations, you've mastered the art of disinformation and collected a loyal army of 9,668 followers. High score. This is your
certificate. Yeah, that's a pretty good score.
Is that good, is it?
Yeah, that's a pretty good score. Yeah. So you're, you know, maybe you're a natural.
I mean, I could have just made up a high score. That would have been shown my ability
to
fake
news.
Yeah,
that's true. Yeah, that is true.
That's right. The metaphor that I often use is, you know, when you go see a magic show, the first time you might be duped by a trick because you don't know how it works, right? And the traditional approach is to educate people so you could say, well, you know, here's a fact sheet or here's a drawing of how the trick works. But our approach is more, it's more like this. What if you do the trick yourself? What if we give you the experience of going through the motions and figuring out how to do the trick on your own? And this is a much more powerful way for people to learn and truly understand something and hence become more immune to it when it actually happens to you. And that's really the key idea behind the game.
And the way it's set up is before you play the game, you kind of do a little test, a little bit of research to see how adept you are at spotting tweets and bits of social media feeds that might not be reliable. And then you do another test afterwards. And I'm guessing what you've found is the game really works and people have got a much more sharp eye for this kind of thing after they've played the game.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So people who give informed consent to participate in scientific research receive this this pretest, and they play the game for about 15 to 20 minutes, and then they get the same test, and we see how people improve in their ability to detect these techniques. So, you know, some of them are specific to social media, for example, and impersonating other people online. So you might tweak a Twitter handle. And you know, people don't actually spot this the first time around, that something has been manipulated and they're actually being duped by a false account. But, you know, in the post-test, people do catch on, or a lot of people do, to this sort of technique.
What are the other things, Sander, that we can do to combat fake news, do you think? What's the sort of basket of things that can be done?
I think what we tried to do initially is to get this idea of what we call pre-bunking. So rather than debunking, pre-bunking on the policy agenda as a new tool to be considered in the sort of misinformation space.
Tell us about pre-bunking.
Well, what we just talked about, the vaccine and the inoculation metaphor, just another term for that is pre-bunking. And we came up with that term mainly in opposition to debunking. So people started sort of differentiating between the two. But largely, to answer your question, what I think we should do is have a multi-layered post-truth defense system. And the way that would work is that pre-bunking should be the first thing that we attempt. So before people are exposed to a myth, we preemptively protect them through, you know, the sort of vaccine metaphor. If that doesn't work, we could try real-time fact-checking and rebuttals as a second layer of defense. If that doesn't work, we can still try debunking. And then hopefully, you know, by the end of that, you know, multi-layer defense system, that's a sufficient sort of, you know, wall of protection to have a well-informed discussion about politics and evidence and science and society without the disruption of these sort of disinformation campaigns.
So we have a thing on the podcast called the Jeffocracy, where Jeff is the supreme ruler peddling lots of fake news. Now, to just sort of ignore the sort of misinformation parts of the Jeffocracy. If Jeff were to make you the minister for...
Misinformation? Disinformation?
No. Minister for countering disinformation.
Not the minister of truth, please.
Minister for honest and accurate information. What's the first thing you would do, apart from sort of dismiss, get rid of Jeff, but we'll take that as read.
So the first thing I would do, and I don't mean to sound like a broken record, but I just think that there's this huge value in a proactive approach, especially when it comes to disinformation and misinformation. Everything we know about how people process information tells us that it's so much more difficult to correct things when they've already happened, when people have already been exposed to a myth or a falsehood. So that would really be my focus, drilling down that sort of single point of being more proactive rather than reactive.
I think that all sounds good. Do you see there was no mention of bringing down the Jeffocracy?
Well, you're going to have a bit of a problem, though, because you're going to have a sort of contradiction, which is the guy you're appointing as Minister for Information is going to be trying to inform people better, which will run totally counter to your wish to spread fake news about the Jeffocracy.
Where is this insurgency coming from? Sander van der Linden, thank you so much.
Yeah, my pleasure.
We're joined now by Samantha Bradshaw, who is a researcher at the Oxford Internet Institute, working on their computational propaganda project. Samantha, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So we're obviously talking about fake news. Lots of people know about fake news. Tell us about the scale of the threat posed by fake news and disinformation in UK elections. What's the scale of the threat sort of here, would you say?
So we've certainly been seeing the scale, the scope, and the intensity of disinformation campaigns on social media grow over the past couple of years, particularly starting around the Brexit referendum. That's when we really started to see a lot of really divisive narratives, a lot of information that was not factually true being spread about the referendum and the campaign. So we see disinformation campaigns being used by a variety of actors for political purposes. Some of that is homegrown by domestic interest groups, political parties themselves, but some of it is also foreign interference and other states who have some kind of geopolitical goal and see social media as this new medium to exert power and influence.
Talk to us about the techniques that are used and how these are facilitated by the business models of the tech companies.
Yeah, so social media has a number of characteristics, you could say, that empower propaganda. One of these characteristics has to do with the precision that you can now get because of our personal data that platforms collect. And then that data is used to tailor and refine certain messages that will already appeal to us based on who we are as individuals. Another thing that's really interesting has to do with automation. Automation often comes in the form of what we call a political bot, which is essentially a fake account. It's an account that is scripted. It's a piece of code, and it's designed to mimic human behavior. So it might do things like, share, retweet, comment even on posts.
I've heard a lot about these bots. How do you tell a bot from a non-bot? Like on Twitter, for example.
It becomes increasingly difficult. Before, when there wasn't very much attention being paid to these bots, they would, you know, very crudely just be liking, sharing, retweeting things like crazy, like operating at a scale like that no human could actually operate at, liking things like thousands of times, for example. But the platforms have adapted to these kinds of accounts and these kinds of crude automation techniques. So we don't see that happening as much anymore.
And the big tech companies, social media companies, how much do you think they genuinely see this as a problem? And how much do you think, well, they're thinking it's been a good source of income for us, but it's also a big PR problem. Let's do the bare minimum.
a lot of the responses that we've seen come out of the platform so far really have just scratched the surface, and they're really kind of bare minimum responses to addressing the problem. And the reason for that is because disinformation and fake news is so closely tied to the business model of these companies. Social media platforms are designed to keep us hooked, to keep our attention, because the longer that we're on these platforms, the more they can deliver advertisements to us, which generate revenue. And so they're constantly trying to keep us engaged by delivering users information that is highly engaging. And that often has to do with things that are highly emotional, whether that be, you know, like a positive cat meme or, you know, some wonderful story about some animals, because, you know, feelings of joy can be very powerful emotions. But even more powerful are emotions like fear, like anger, a lot more of these negative emotions. And that's what we see a lot of the disinformation and the fake news playing off of.
So given that that's what social media companies are trying to do, they're trying to keep us on there for as long as possible, the stirring up of these emotions is a tool by which they're doing that. To some extent, they can't be trusted to self-regulate. So do governments need to be doing more? And if so, what does that look like? Because these things don't have borders. Does it have to be international cooperation of governments?
Government certainly has a role to play. I think, you know, with every new communication technology, there's always this really uncomfortable learning period of, you know, understanding how exactly, well, first of all, what the extent of the problem is, and then how exactly we can regulate it. And it happened with, you know, newspaper, with radio, TV, and now we're just thinking about this in the age of social media again. One of the things that I always advocate for is more procedural accountability from the platforms. Procedural accountability is the rules about the rules. And so how Facebook is determining its policies to take down certain kinds of content, take down certain kinds of accounts, just having more insight into those kinds of processes so that we can start to evaluate whether or not the company is doing enough and where the gaps are. Because right now, everything is very much a black box, and there is very, very limited insight into the functioning of these platforms.
Is part of what's going on here that if you take Britain, we're not allowed to do political advertising on television. And so now we've got this whole area, which is more important than television, where you can do advertising, and it's pretty Wild West-ish. In America, political advertising, there is political advertising on television, but it's relatively regulated. I mean, I can't help feeling that in both countries, we're treating social media as if it's a special case, when it's not clear why it should be a special case.
Yeah, I think that's certainly the case when we're looking at political advertising specifically. I think a lot of the digital campaigning laws that we have in place for traditional media have not yet been extended to the digital realm. And that's why we're seeing a lot of abuse of these kinds of platforms for campaigning, or, you know, not even abuse, but, you know, maybe pushing the boundaries a little bit of compared to some of the more traditional media forms. But I think it's really important to mention here, though, that the advertising part of disinformation is actually just a very small component of the problem. If you look at what Russia did in the United States elections in 2016, they spent about $200,000 on ads, but that only reached a couple million Americans, whereas their organic engagement it reached so many more people, and they didn't pay a penny for that content.
And can you explain to us what deepfakes are? This is where video is manipulated to make somebody, you can make them look like they were somewhere that they never were, like they said something they never said.
Yeah, so deepfake technology is, you know, what a lot of people are thinking is going to be the next generation of disinformation. And, you know, we're already seeing more images and memes and videos being used in these campaigns. And again, part of this actually comes down to, you know, the economics of attention. There's so much information that's being shared online, and the platforms want to keep our attention. And so there's this kind of natural evolution of moving from the disinformation website to these deep fake technologies where someone can be made to look like they're saying something that they've never actually said.
On the podcast, we have a utopia. It's called The Jeffocracy, with me installed as a benign dictator. I want no disinformation in this utopia unless it's coming from me. If I made you minister for tackling disinformation, or minister for information, sounds a bit like Chemical Ali, that one, doesn't it? But what is the first thing you would do day one to tackle this stuff at government level?
The first thing I would do would be to think more about user privacy and data, because that's a large part of the problem. It's how information gets tailored to us through ads, but, you know, also organically based on our interests. And right now, users don't have a lot of control over the kinds of data that social media companies collect about us. And so I would start there by thinking more about how to put that power back into the hands of the people.
Sounds good. Samantha Bradshaw, it's a really important problem and really important work that you're doing. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
All right, speaking to us now from Helsinki, we have Director of Current Affairs and Communications at Finland's Ministry for Foreign Affairs, Vesa Häkkinen.
I think you did it better in the rehearsal, actually.
The pronunciation?
Yeah, you did. Well, I put you off your stride, didn't you?
Marks out of 10 for my pronunciation, Vesa.
That was very, very fine. That was very, very fine. Thank you.
That's because the Finns are such polite people.
It's exactly that, yeah. thank you for talking to us. Let's start by asking you, so in Finland, your anti-disinformation campaign, it started back in 2014. And I wondered if you could talk to us about why it started, what the origins were, and why the situation in Finland in particular makes this a pertinent subject with regards to foreign interference?
That's a very good question. Of course, we saw something happening in Europe and in the world overall, 2014 and even a bit earlier. But it was a kind of a sea change for us. And as it happened in the neighborhood, I'm talking about Russia interfering business of Ukraine and inside Ukraine. And at the same time, there were, let's say, massive disinformation campaigns, for example, concerning the downing of MH17, the Malaysian airliner from Holland to Malaysia. And we realized that we need to, let's say, wake up and do something. Actually, we were woken up already straight after the Second World War, in that sense that we decided in Finland that we need something that we call comprehensive approach to security. And of course, then we are talking about the safety of the country. And as we are in a relatively small country, we realize that we need to do things together. So this is a long route, but this actual campaigning against disinformation, it happened a bit later in that sense.
And what? Tell us about the actions that the Finnish government has taken. What give us the different things you've done to counter disinformation? What's the program?
2014, what happened concretely was that we formed a network of authorities. This means like 30 authorities having common meetings once a month, for example. We started common training. We started with training of 100 civil servants, which is a pretty high number in a country like ours. That was the first step. And then we've been training maybe, I would say, several thousand, more than 10,000 Finnish citizens, including media journalists and others. And in addition, of course, we made all this public because the raising of awareness of citizens is always very important when we are talking about disinformation and misuse of information. So then you need to say that we have a problem and the authorities at least are trying to take the problem seriously.
And I'm right in thinking that in Finland, the trust in both the media and the transparency within the democracy is one of the highest, if not the highest, in the world.
Yeah, right.
So do you think that means that the Finns less susceptible to fake news and disinformation?
I'm sure that it has something to do with the fact that we are somehow resilient also. As you mentioned, in the press freedom index, Finland is, I think, in the second position or third position nowadays. But when we are talking about Finns' trust on media, I think we are number one. So we trust our media, and of course it also demands professionalism from the media.
And if you think about your citizens, the 10,000 or whatever it was that are being trained, how are they selected? What do they do? What happens at the end? Has it had an effect? Tell us about that.
Yeah, that's a very good question. It's only, let's say, selected people in that sense that, of course, we need to have educated population in the country. And when it comes to media literacy, for example, we don't start it at schools. We start it already in the kindergartens. It's in the curricula in that sense that everyone somehow is affected by the fact that they need to understand that be critical.
Can you talk to us a little bit more about that? So kids under seven, there is something even at that age going on about trust in media. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
That's something which is a bit peculiar, but nevertheless, I've even seen kids programs in TV where we had this teddy bear having his adventures and being critical on the news. So we are having our narrative available for everyone that you must be critical daily. Day after day. So this is very, very interesting. But for the kindergartens and for the schools in the curricula, there is a thing which is media literacy. Somehow we try to have an effect on children as well.
And can we talk a little bit about this year? The government ran a public information campaign to counter disinformation in the parliamentary elections. Can you tell us what this involved and what impact it had and why you felt the need to do it?
Yeah, we had both the national parliamentary elections, first in April and in May there were the EU Parliament's elections. So we formed a task force already summer 2018, which consists of various authorities. They started a program. Of course, this was made public, so sending a message to the larger public. And then we had training of the election officials, even the parties. All the parties were participating. We were talking about information influencing disinformation. We had a media campaign in TV, in other media, saying that we have the best elections in the world. That was the slogan, saying that we really have a robust thing. You only things you need is a pen and a paper and the box. So in that sense, it's not that easy to somehow from outside to try to have an effect on the result. But in the let's say information sphere, we needed to do something. To be honest, there wasn't too much mess around. So I think we had pretty peaceful elections, both in national and also in the EU level.
And finally, I just wanted to ask you, what do you think a country like the UK can learn from Finland's approach to tackling disinformation?
I would say the same thing that we demand here in Finland. there are three demands, maybe. One is to demand openness or transparency of the administration. Finland, for example, we are number one in the transparency index, but nevertheless, this is a thing that we need to need ourselves, that the administration would be more open and transparent. And the other one is, of course, journalism, media. We need to have more professionalism in the media and in the journalism. As I mentioned, we trust the media, but still they need to do their work every day better and better. As I mentioned, the MH17, for example, in Finnish media, I saw stories which were directly from the Kremlin workbook. But that's another thing. I think Finnish journalism has taken serious steps forward. And the last thing, everyone should demand education. So it's the basic education plus some special things concerning the media literacy. So everyone should be day after day, every day, again and again, trained to tackle these problems. And in that sense, we can take steps to increase our resilience of the whole nation. Maybe these could also fit for the UK.
Can we also add to that more stories about teddy bears being critical about what they read in the newspapers?
Yeah, I think that was very, very, very good story. That's something that everyone should have.
I agree. Vesa, thank you so much for talking to us.
Oh, no problem. Anytime.
Well, look, I mean, there is something important that's come up in the discussion, which, you know, I can now reveal, which is that the bacon sandwich was a deep fake. It didn't ever happen.
You're ahead of your time. I never wanted, Obama.
I never wanted really to say, but, you know, because I just thought, well,
no one's going to believe you.
No one's going to believe me. But
trust in politicians was so undermined.
Exactly. What did you think of this discussion?
I found it very interesting. The process of getting people to be able to spot what's real and fake and the education is very interesting to me. We've all got those uncles who post insane stuff on Facebook as if it was fact. And maybe Finland have got it right. Maybe you start this in kindergarten with stories about teddy bears.
Spot the bot.
I think that's
important. I personally think that the tech companies do have a lot more they should be doing. I mean, this Elizabeth Warren thing where she posted an ad on Facebook saying Mark Zuckerberg had endorsed Trump, basically then says it's not true, but she sort of dared Facebook to take it down and do something about it. They said, we're not going to do anything about it. She's in a ding-dong with them about it. You know, it doesn't seem unreasonable to say that if politicians or anyone has a kind of lies, there's something tagged to it saying this has been checked by third party fact checkers, it's not true. But the one area that Facebook are not applying that, as I understand it, is to politicians. And I just don't understand why? I mean, you know, honestly, as a politician, you know, you'd have a lot more anxiety if, you know, I'm sure for politicians, for political advertising on the internet, if it was going to be tagged as untrue.
Mm.
Because that's like, you know, well, he lied. Don't you think?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I suppose they are just extremely scared of looking like they have a political stance.
But I think maybe it dates back to the sort of sense of the, you know, isn't the best thing about the internet that it's sort of unregulated. Libertarianism that's slightly gone quite problematic. I mean, it's not unreasonable. They could get an independent organisation to do the fact-checking. But I think it'll be okay because Nick Clegg's in charge of it now.
The Finland thing is interesting as well, just because the transparency and trust in institutions is so much higher there.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, an adjoining issue to this is how do you rebuild that trust in our society?
I heard this really interesting thing the other day by somebody saying that Trump wasn't trying to persuade people that what he said was true. He was trying to persuade people that what everyone said was untrue. And therefore you essentially couldn't trust anything, and therefore you just had to go with your prejudices.
Right.
And I thought that was a very interesting point that we think it's about sort of, you know, where he's told something that's untrue. Isn't he going to be worried he's going to be caught out? But that is just totally missing the point.
Mm.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Do let us know if you've got any thoughts on disinformation and fake news. I mean, we've
spot the bot.
Yeah, we would welcome any ideas, as well as the conversations we've been having here on the podcast. We've been sitting with our head in our hands a little bit thinking about it, and you know what where this goes in the future. So any bright ideas, please, you can get in touch with us. All the ways, different ways, social media and so on, email of getting in touch with us are on our website, cheerfulpodcast.com.
And people should sign up to our newsletter to find out more of the background on what we've covered on today and other shows.
It's looking very good, our newsletter. Cheers. I think. Yeah. This comes from Matt, who says, courgette recipes. Hi, Jeff and Ed. A great recipe for using your courgettes is this lasagna from BBC Good Food. It's something I've started cooking recently in a bid to get more vegetarian meals into our diet. He then includes a link. Could we put that in the newsletter? Maybe. I mean, he does make it sound very appealing.
Really?
This recipe, yeah. I mean, we had a bit of a thing going with the courgettes at the weekend, but I think this looks better. He says, can you please give a shout out to Ginny Mills for introducing me to the podcast?
Ah,
hello, Ginny Mills.
This comes from Phil Smith. He says, I've got a great idea for a make your own sandwich.
You're making this up. You're making it up. You're not reading a letter. Let it go.
I just thought it's fake news.
It's definitely that.
Right. This actually comes from Pete Tomlin. Listening to the Extinction Rebellion episode of Cheerful Podcast, I had the realization that up to about a year ago, whenever I think about the climate or nature, I'd get so depressed. Now with XR and the school strikes, I'm not saying I'm all happy clappy, but I'm a lot less pessimistic. Amazing the difference in the discussion within such a short space of time. I tend to agree with that, although I wasn't so keen on the protest on the tube. Counterproductive, really.
I think so. Yeah. I think so. I think like a lot of people within Extinction Rebellion would say the same thing.
Yeah.
And this on the Extinction Rebellion episode comes from Will, who says, I'm a listener from New Jersey.
Wow.
The Garden New State. Jersey. And I just finished this week's episode on Extinction Rebellion civil disobedience. I liked how your guests highlighted how much organising work these sort of mass movements require in order to be successful. However, I was disappointed that you didn't take a look back at Occupy Wall Street, the movement from earlier this decade.
Good point.
While income equality is now a central issue in the 2020 Democratic presidential debates, Occupy itself as a movement seems to have fizzled out. Was it too confrontational, filled with too many anarchist crusties, or something else? It seems that XR is less closely connected with figures from the WTO and Iraq war protests than Occupy. Does the messenger change how the message is received? I mean, I don't know. I think you make the point there in the body of what you've written, Will, is that it's the issues that were raised by Occupy are the issues that have been talked about in the mainstream of the Democratic candidate.
But I think he's right, isn't he, that Extinction Rebellion seems like they have a more thought-out strategy.
Yeah.
Do you think we should claim the word crusty? Do you think it can be sort of claimed and sort of re...
Would you go full crusty?
But is there a way you could sort of prefix it with something to make it sound nicer? Trusty crusty.
That's good. He adds, P.S., where do I apply for a passport for the Jeffocracy?
Where does he apply for a passport?
Don't know, but we need to think about what colour the passports are going to be.
Yeah, what's the design?
Yeah, maybe tie-dye.
By the order of the crusty. By the order of the Jeffocracy.
Yeah.
Email us, reasons@cheerfulpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter, @cheerfulpodcast. Or search for our Facebook page, Reasons to be Cheerful Podcast.
Time for this week's Cheerful People, and our cheerful person is the author of a new book, Chaos with Ed Miliband. It is Tom Noble, or should I say Roger Gammon?
Hello. You, it's a page-turner.
I've never seen you so interested in anything.
No, exactly. I'll let you take.
You know, we've had these various
interview.
Reports and weighty tomes and people talking about these big ideas. And yeah, as soon as it's caricatures of yourself, you know, I'm struggling
to keep your attention. I've just opened a page here. 14th of August 2015. This is while the Labour leadership contest is going on, and it has this sort of parallel universe today. Ed Miliband walked to the local park to feed some stale bread to the ducks. Got pecked several times by an overly aggressive swan. I mean, it's uncanny.
I've been watching you.
You've been stalking him. You've been hacking his phone.
I mean, it is uncanny.
So let's address this first of all. Roger Gammon, nom de plume. How did you come up with that?
Well, this book is kind of out at the same time as a certain former prime minister's book. And over the last few years, the term Gammon, I guess, has come to be used as a disparaging term for ruddy-faced, we won the war Brexiteers, maybe. So it worked on that level. And then also Roger Gammon kind of ties back to a certain incident with that former prime minister involving a pig.
Of course.
So it kind of worked on two levels.
Who are you, Tom? I mean, what's the story behind you and and how the book came about?
So I work for a publisher called Orion, and the book is published by Orion. And we all kind of saw the news about David Cameron's book being announced, and we thought, you know, that's interesting. If he wants to tell his story, that's fair enough, but maybe we should offer something alternative and a bit more lighthearted.
Ed's not listening to you, he's just reading the book.
It's quite fun. Today, Ed Miliband got asked for a selfie by a bloke in a local cafe, was happy to oblige despite the man calling him David four times.
I mean, that is your life. So David Cameron...
I mean, it actually happened to be on the street.
So they announced David Cameron's publishing his memoirs. Yeah. You, in your publishing company, think...
We thought, you know, we can take the piss a little bit. Sorry, can I say
piss? You say piss, yeah.
All right, good. Yeah, we could take the
I'd
piss.
I'd heard words like that before.
Definitely.
He said
them. Good. Thought, yeah, you know, we can do something here to kind of offer an alternative to readers who perhaps are not fans of David Cameron and find the idea of him publishing his memoir slightly, not to their taste. We can offer something different that's a bit more lighthearted, a bit more, you know, something a bit more fun and that shows maybe a kinder side to politics and something a bit more engaging in that way.
And this is one of those books that people are going to be out in November, December shopping. They're going to see it on the counter in the bookshop.
Yeah,
and think,
hopefully.
Oh, yeah, this is the one for my husband, or this is the one for my
mum. You've obviously, like, stalked me because you're like, you know I like Skeletrics.
Yeah.
You know that I've made jokes about having a man bun.
Well, you know, we wanted to make it...
I mean, obviously, like, you know, this is, like, scary. This is like Mark Zuckerberg. Wow. Anyway.
Although I was slightly disappointed there was nothing about the podcast in the book.
I mean, it's always got to come back to you, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay, this one isn't about you, honestly.
If it does well, there could be a sequel.
Ed, it's what I've done to keep you busy these last few years since 2015.
That is true. It is funny. Anyway, keep going with your interview, Jeff.
You keep going reading your book.
Yeah.
So you work in a publisher's. You've never done anything like this before?
It's not really.
A Twitter account?
Who did the illustrations?
Like that. That's a guy we've worked with a few times before called Adam, who's great. So we worked together on the kind of the look of the book and the illustrations.
What's Adam's surname? We should give him...
Adam Rushton,
he gets some...
But his credit is on the book as Milligan. That's the name he wanted to be.
I see.
But yeah, he was fantastic. He was great to work with. And I think he captured you quite well. I hope you feel the same.
Do you feel, in your experience, Ed, because obviously a lot...
Ate four bananas back to back, then felt a little bit sick for an hour or so. Sounds like...
It's very close to the truth.
Yeah, close to the bone.
As somebody who's been caricatured a lot by cartoonists over the years, who does you best, do you think?
Oh, God, I don't know.
Do you think this Milligan's probably up
there?
No, but
I think this is relatively complimentary, actually. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Good, that's what we wanted.
No, I mean the caricature is relatively complimentary.
So
performed his annual sock draw audit. Four pairs successfully rematched. How do you know? Seven sorry singles binned and one damaged walking sock darned back to full fitness.
Yeah, it was some of them were... Once we'd got a few scenarios and we kind of got this style, I think it was quite easy to do. It was a lot of fun to come up with the ideas. Some are quite ridiculous. Some are a bit more surreal. Some are just really mundane. It was just trying to show what this kind of chaos could have been.
And you sort of juxtapose, each page juxtaposes what's going on in the real world, yes, in the news, with what's what you imagine to be going on in Ed's life, which, as it turns out, is very close to the truth.
Yeah, we just went right back to David Cameron's famous tweet about chaos with Ed Miliband and thought, well, what would that chaos have been compared to what has actually been happening? Because obviously there's been terrible things happening every day, sometimes several times a day. So it was quite... There's plenty of material there to work with.
Well, it's not gone well since, has it, really, for the country?
No,
I think it's fair to say. I mean, let's be honest, how bad could it have been under me compared to this? It's a pretty low bar, isn't it?
I've said to you before, though, I mean, I'm saying it would be better, but if you'd become Prime Minister, here's what would have happened. You would have done a good job, but some minister in your cabinet would have done something embarrassing. It would have caused a scandal at some point. There'd be something with data. There's always something, and you would have been tarnished a little bit. As it is, you're this golden boy in people's minds. It's this Prime Ministership that, compared to what has happened in real life, is golden. It's the Bobby Kennedy effect.
It's not so great for the country, though, is it?
No, really? It's not, but I'm just trying to make you feel better.
Right, okay. I mean, somebody did tweet the other day I thought it was quite, sort of telling. They said something like, I'm old enough to remember when it was controversial that the Chancellor put a tax on pasties.
Any interest in the movie rights to this book yet?
Well, I mean, that would be quite something.
Who's going like to play me in the movie?
You must have given this some thought.
Wallace. Ray Romano. Do you remember Ray Romano?
Yeah. Yes, from Everybody Loves Raymond.
I once got confused for Ray Romano on an aeroplane by a stewardess. She said, I know who you are. And I said, really? She said, yeah, you're Ray Romano from Everybody Loves Raymond.
I said, no,
I'm really not.
We should do 1 week a list of all the people that people have mistaken you for. It's a long list.
Harry Redknapp.
Yes, I know.
In my constituency, I know that is really weird.
I mean, that is quite confusing.
I know, it's like...
Nick Clegg on a number of occasions.
Nick Clegg on a number of occasions. I feared Nigel Farage once.
Really?
Yeah.
I think that is somebody winding you up.
Do you think?
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe.
So Tom, the book is out now.
The book is out now, yeah. Ideal Christmas gift, hopefully. But yeah, it's out and people seem to be liking it and I'm just relieved that Ed likes it.
Yeah,
definitely.
I think this qualifies as an endorsement, does it?
No,
Ed?
No, it definitely, I mean, it's uncanny. It is uncanny. Uncannily accurate.
Tom Noble, author of Chaos with Ed Miliband, thanks.
Suffered
so much.
Minor grazes and two bruised knees after falling off his unicycle. Nothing that a generous smear of antiseptic can't fix.
Tom, thanks for
coming.
Thank
you very much, guys. Cheers.
Reasons to be cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We are in the outro. And I have something for the outro. This comes from Lynn Davis, who says... you remember we said get in touch with what Ed would look like with lovely blonde ringlets.
Oh,
I can't even remember how this came up in conversation.
I did have blonde ringlets when I was a child.
Right. And Lynn says, this is from Lynn Davis Design. She says, your Millie blonde is attached. And there we have a picture of you.
Yeah. That's more like a wig, isn't it? That's more like a judicial wig.
Well, maybe your wife, who is, of course, a judge, she could get you one of these wigs.
I am very grateful to Lynn Davis.
I think it looks good.
I'll take it under advisement. You've never been tempted to dye your hair.
What do you mean? Because I'm going grey?
Going is a sort of generous way of putting it.
All right, don't look like a badger. Calm it down a bit.
What you've never been tempted?
I think it's too late, isn't it? I think if you've gone as grey as now, if I was to turn up, with Damian Lewis style red hair next week, I don't think you'd approve.
No, it's true. Right, I'd like to thank Sander van der Linden, Visa Hakkinen, and Samantha Bradshaw. How was that?
It was fine. Visa Hakkinen.
That was good.
I'm not even sure if that's right. And thanks to Tom Noble for keeping you so entertained with his book, Chaos with Ed Miliband. And
thanks to the electorate for having avoided that fate.
That was a thanks through gritted teeth. Emma Caution produces our podcast with research and backup from Joel Pearce and Joe Kenyon. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. James Deacon made the little idents. The music was by Ed Seed. And the artwork wasn't designed by
Emily Power,
but it was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been a deep fake.
He's been a trusty crusty.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.